Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 13th of April. All things political for this hour, the first half hour of the program, Jim Lehrer is going to be with us. In the second half hour of the program, Ahmed Rashid, author of Descent into Chaos, the U.S. and the Disaster in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia. Jim Lehrer, of course, the executive editor and the anchor of the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on PBS. He has a new novel that's out. We won't have a lot of time to talk about that, but I do want to mention it, and we'll talk a little bit about it at the end of the half hour. He's such an incredibly prolific writer. This is his 19th novel, and this one is about a young, talented athlete, Johnny Wrigley, his name is, who dreams of playing ball in the major leagues, but he finds his life going in a different direction because it's April of 1944, and he's a newly minted Marine on a troop that's training, a troop train that's heading for California, where he's going to be shipped overseas to fight in the Pacific Theater. So it's about war and sports and love and all of that. Oh, Johnny is the name of the book. He's going to be with us to talk about all things political, and we'll be welcoming phone calls. Obviously, the big story of the week, and we talked a little bit about this, and many of you, I'm sure, followed this quite closely over the weekend, and that's the rescue, rather dramatic rescue, that did result in the killing of three pirate captors of Captain Richard Phillips over the weekend, and pirates are vowing revenge here. And it raises questions about what's going on, certainly in that part of the world, and what's going on in Somalia. We'll talk about the next thing that's on the plate of this new administration. And we will look at, you know, the TARP funds. We'll look at, ask Jim Lehrer what he thought about the president's trip to Europe. And, you know, at some point I got to mention the new puppy. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join the conversation. If you'd like to send an email, it's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Jim Lehrer, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Kathleen. Thank you.
Another new novel, sir.
Hey. Gotta stay busy.
You just are writing them one after another, aren't you?
You're right.
Yeah, I know. It's terrific. Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about it before we talk about other parts of the world. This is a World War II. It's baseball. It's love. Are these all areas of great interest to you? It makes for a good novel, huh?
You're right. Well, starting with number one, World War II. I grew up in World War II, and as you know, part of the story involves this kid who's a baseball player, wanted to be a professional baseball player. That's what I wanted to be when I was a little boy. He's on a troop train. He had joined the Marines because of World War II. He did join the Marines because of World War II, and he's on his way to the West Coast and the Pacific on a troop train, and the troop train stops in Wichita, Kansas. That's where I grew up, in Wichita, Kansas, and he has a love experience on during a break at the train station, they let the Marines out for a break at the train station in Wichita, and I didn't have that experience, okay? So I was just 10 years old then, but the rest of it is, it's about his dreams about being a baseball player, but also once he meets this magic girl and he wants to find her after the war, and he can't, you know, it's the story of kind of trying to find her and kind of restore his dream to reality, and that's about it.
Yeah. I didn't know you wanted to be a professional baseball player. Were you good?
No. That's the reason it didn't work. But it did get me into journalism, Kathleen. I was playing in high school in Southeast Texas, a place called Beaumont, and I was not a very good ball player, but I wanted to be a professional ball player. The coach said, "You know, you might want to try to think about another career path because this isn't going to work for you." But that's when I decided to be a sports writer. Huh. There were sports writers that came to our games, and I liked that. And I thought, "Well, I'll just do that." And I had a teacher who said something nice about something I had written. So the two things went together when I was about 16, and that's when I decided to be a writer, a newspaper person, as well as a fiction writer, and I've been doing it more or less ever since.
You sure have, in full force. It's nice to have baseball. I find myself a little more interested in baseball this year, and I think it's because everything is a little bit gloomy. I mean, it's happy, too, but the economy is bad, and it's nice to become absorbed in a baseball game.
That's true. I don't I've never been one to see baseball in great metaphoric terms, but there is something about, there's something steady and slow-paced and reassuring. There's no question about it. I agree with you, Kathleen, about baseball. And I've always felt that way myself. I've always enjoyed playing it, but more importantly, I've enjoyed watching it, because when you sit down, you know it's going to take 9 innings, and you know it's going to go one pitch at a time. Everything else goes boom, 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 boom. But baseball doesn't go that way.
And things can change. I'm still thinking about last night's game. We're Brewers fans, you know, in our family.
Oh,
but
right.
The fact that Prince Fielder almost hit this grand slam home run for the first time in his life, and it was caught. It was just one of those moments you could watch again and again. And then he saluted the guy who caught it. It was a good moment.
But you see, you just made the point. I mean, you remember the one play where this kid, because it was a memorable play, sure. But this the kid almost hit his first grand slam, and but those are the that's you don't remember plays in other sports like that. It's in a way that that I don't know. It's just different.
It is different. It's a good game. Well, let's go from 16-year-olds who were sports writers like you to 16-year-olds who are pirates. Which, what a story, the way this thing played out. It was too bad that these pirates had to be killed, but I guess they had this AK-47 in the back of the captain. It just, once again, here we are in this world that's so sophisticated, so modern in so many ways, and yet for days we've got these pirates from Somalia, this dirt poor country, holding this captain on this little boat, and people trying to figure out what to do. It's just such a juxtaposition of everything, isn't it?
Oh, it is. It is. The giant and the mouse. We've seen this many, many times. And I must say, in this case, there are always the big picture stories, but there's always the human story. And in this case, the captain kept his cool at the beginning, let his crew go and his ship go, and let them keep him the hostage, because remember, all the pirates want is money. That's what they're in this for. And they felt that, well, why not let the captain remain as the sole hostage? Well, by doing that, it set up this kind of, you know, this weird situation. And I think he, I don't know, who knows, we'll find out, but who knows the details yet. But it's clearly, on the surface, it appears that the captain really acted in a heroic way and did the right thing for his crew and the right thing for everybody concerned. And yes, the pirates themselves got killed, but they were, according to at least the reports, what the admiral says and is who called the shot, that they had an AK-47 right up against the captain, and the things had gotten tense, and these remarkable Navy SEALs took their shots, can you believe that they hit
those
trees?
Isn't that something? I know.
In rough sea,
in the nighttime.
Yes, in nighttime. Of course, they have those night vision scopes and all of that sort of stuff. But even then, I mean, they only had one shot at it, because that they could have very easily have killed that captain, and it all worked.
Somebody, one of our guests last week, a Somalia expert, said that this particular incident, because the United States was involved, the Navy involved in a big way, that this could be a game changer when it comes to piracy on these seas. Do you agree?
I do. I think that if the Somalia pirates had an idea that they could just keep going on and doing this because the international community wasn't going to do anything about it, those days are now over. I mean, the United States Navy is now involved. You know, Gates and the U.S. military sent an armada of ships in there, and they're not about to let this happen again. And so it is a game changer. Who knows what's going to happen? Of course, the pirates on the other side are threatening, and that they're going to start killing Americans and all of that. Well, the more they threaten, the larger the armada, the larger the whatever is going to happen,
yes.
And who knows where this is all going to end.
Why is it that it took, because there are so many people who are still being held hostage and boats being held hostage, why is it that the international community didn't jump right in a long time ago to figure this out?
They just couldn't get their act together.
Oh.
I wondered about that myself, Kathleen. They've had a lot of discussions about it, but they didn't want to alienate, a great word, they didn't want to alienate certain factions in certain parts of the world. And so they couldn't agree on what action to take, and so they just decided to let it play out. The Saudis, and also in several cases, see, it worked. In other words, the pirates were it was working for the pirates. The pirates are getting millions of dollars. People were paying ransom. The Saudis paid $2.5 million in one of these deals just a short time ago. And so there was no incentive for the pirates to stop. And as long as that was happening, the pirates were obviously going to still be more piracy incidents. So now there's an incentive to stop, and we'll see what happens.
Jim Lehrer is our guest. We have a ton of people who would like to speak with you, Jim, so we'll start taking phone calls on a variety of issues. 800-486-8655 is our number. Ben from Milwaukee, hi.
Yeah, good morning.
Morning.
I mean, it's a pleasure to have a chance to talk with you because I want to thank you, and I think I want to thank you on behalf of a whole lot of people in the world, too, that listen to the NewsHour, because you are the best source of intelligence that anybody can get except in maybe a classified situation.
Thank you, Ben.
And I used to be in one of those situations back in the 60s, and I read the reports and the AP wire coming right over the wire and all that stuff, so I knew what was put out there, and you guys are just really good at what you do.
Thank you.
All right. That's a good way to start.
I appreciate that so much.
Good way to start your day. Muhammad is next from Madison. Hi, Muhammad.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm not sure how much is known, but we have a sizable Somali population here in the United States. Right next door in Minnesota, there's probably over 100,000, sizable number in Columbus, Ohio, and Atlanta, Georgia, all over the place. Most of them are peace-loving people. But I think it just shows one place we should have put our attention towards instead of Iraq. If they really want to punish this 16-year-old kid, I hate to sound like Sam Kinison, but send him back to Somalia and then back it up with trying to help stabilize the situation over there and establish some kind of law and order in that country with international help.
I couldn't agree with you more. I also have. I live in Washington D.C. and I happen to have a very good friend who is a Somalian, and he came to the United States maybe 15, 20 years ago, and is now a U.S. citizen. But he feels exactly the same way you do, and I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, the Somalia thing went sour a few years ago, and some Americans were killed, and the United States just kind of backed off and left it alone, to go into essentially a state of chaos. I think you would agree, and now we're paying a price for that. And of course, as it always happens in these cases, it's the Somalian people that are paying the price. So I think maybe the good that could come out of this awful situation is that the United States could lead an international effort to help the Somalians. Move past this and get back into a world of peace and out of this world of anarchy where they have been.
I agree. Thank you for taking my call.
Hey, thank you for saying that.
Thanks, Muhammad. Remember that story, Jim, from time goes so fast, a couple of months ago, I think, of those teenagers from Minneapolis, I believe, who just disappeared. They were high school students, just disappeared, and it turns out that they went to fight in Somalia.
I know.
Yeah.
I know. I mean, that as Muhammad was saying, I mean, that incident there several years ago where the awful things happened in Mogadishu and all that, I mean, that we just kind of turned our back on it and left it there, and that was clearly we clearly have paid a price for that, and not just we, but they, and all of the theys, particularly in Somalia.
Let's move to the economy for a moment, referencing Frank Rich's column yesterday, which was pretty hard on Lawrence Summers. Do you have concerns that the very people who are trying to figure out where this TARP money is going and distribute this money and be in charge of all this have benefited from some of the wrongs that these companies have done?
Well, you know, Kathleen, I am not I'm not a pundit, so I don't make comments on this kind of stuff. I ask the same kinds of questions
right.
You do of others, but I mean, there are two sides to all of this. If you're going to get a certain situation resolved, let's say the financial system, if you're going to get it fixed, the people who are going to have to do the fixing are people who know something about it. And most of the people, they come from within. And it's a careful and it's a difficult process to find people who have the knowledge and the skills required to repair, fill in the blank, the bus business if it gets into trouble, the healthcare system as it is now in trouble. Anytime you go into a specialized area, you have to deal with people who know something about it. And so when you do that, as what's happening now with the Obama administration trying to fix the financial and the economic thing, they've got people working within the administration who have had professional lives in that area. And so what it requires in order for it to work, but it's in order for it to have, everybody wants this thing to work. I don't care what your politics are. This has got to work. We've got to fix all of this. But the people who are fixing it must have credibility, and they must have the trust of the American people so they can buy some time to say, hey, look, trust us. We're going to try this. We think this is going to work. Trust us. Well, anything that gets in the way of moving toward a trust level is a problem. And in these cases that Frank Rich was writing about and everybody's talking about, the issue is it's not so much whether or not anybody did anything wrong, because if somebody did something wrong, that will be aired, and the transparency elements will make sure that it gets fully aired and people can move on that. The question is, does it inhibit the trust? And we're going to find out, because I don't think when you read very carefully, nobody's alleging that any crimes were committed, there was even any improper conduct. It's just how do we get from here to there, and are these the right people to move us from here to there? And even if they are, do we trust them to do it?
Isn't it remarkable, Jim, how many fronts this administration has acted on? We've got NATO, we've got the summit, we've got Turkey, we've got health care, and oh my gosh, it's one thing after another in a very short period of time. Do you think it's too much? It's almost too much to keep track of.
It is too much to keep track of, probably. But and if you go back through the list, Kathleen, you may disagree. Others may disagree with this, and I'm not sure that everybody can take a different point of view of it. But if you just go through the list, the things you just named, and all the other things we could put on that list, with a couple of exceptions, very few of them are optional. Meaning the new president and his administration, has to act on boom, boom, boom. He had no choice. And where the optional thing comes in is, all right, does he really have to do health care? Well, under his argument, if we don't get to do something about health care costs, then the economic situation is never going to get into hand. Because, you know, because the cost of health care goes up 27%, inflation goes up 5%. You can't keep those figures are not going to hold much longer. So you got to do something about health care. At least that's his argument. And the issue of like NATO and all that, we got people dying in our name in Afghanistan. And so you can't put that aside. And Iraq, the same thing. So you got to move on that. So a lot of things he doesn't have any choice about. And whether he's adding too much to it, too many other, for instance, North Korea. North Korea fired a missile, and that wasn't the case of the president sitting back saying, "Well, let's have a problem with North Korea." It just happened,
right.
And the same thing now with Somalia, and so these things. This unfortunately goes with the territory, and so the list is long. I agree with you. I mean, it's stunning.
It is stunning.
I mean, it's just incredible.
No.
All the things that are there. I mean, when he wakes up in the morning, my goodness, he probably has to go through them alphabetically. to get to a ball. And it's an extraordinary thing. There's no question about it. I've been around a long time. I do not ever recall a situation where a president has been confronted with as many high-level, difficult situations at the same time as he has right now.
Jim Lehrer. We'll take a couple more phone calls for him, and then we'll switch guests for all things political. Jim, of course, the executive editor and author of The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. He has another novel, and it's a good one. Oh, Johnny is the name of it, a novel which is about a young fellow who would like to play Major League Baseball. He is diverted by World War II, and he is shipped overseas to fight in the Pacific Theater. There's also a love interest here, and baseball and war and all of that is in Oh, Johnny, his new novel. He's written 19 novels now. Isn't that something? Our number is 800-486-8655, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We take a couple more phone calls for Jim. John is from Milwaukee is next. Hi, John.
Oh, hi. Hi, Kathleen. I didn't want to. I was calling about the Somali thing. I just
That's
wanted
right.
to make a comment that, and Mr. Lehrer probably knows about this. I heard that part of the problem is that international fishing fleets have fished out the water so much that these young men have to turn to piracy to make a living.
You know, and, John, I've read the same thing.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I don't, but I don't know the I don't know the factual basis of that. I know that's what they say, and but I can't. I don't have enough information myself to, I can confirm I've heard it too, but that's all I can say.
Could I mention one other thing?
Sure.
If you talk about the Ted Stevens trial, to me that sounds like a setup, you know, by the Republican administration to get him off, to have the trial declared void.
But it's the Democrat, it was the Democratic Attorney General who made, Eric Holder, who made the decision to miss all charges and all of that. I don't think I'm not sure there's politics in there. There's no evidence of it that I have seen. I read about that pretty carefully. I think it was just it had less to do with politics than it did with just some folks who didn't do their jobs very well.
Thank you, John, very much for the call. And what about the Republicans? Are they fashioning themselves into a smart and interesting opposition?
Well, time will tell. It's too early to say.
It is early to
say. Yeah. They got a problem. They've got a president with a 62% approval rating, and yet a lot of the policies, a few of the key policies of Barack Obama's are not going down well, at least with the opinion polls. But Obama's doing very well, And he is seen as being somebody in charge and all that sort of stuff. So the Republicans are in a difficult, but they can't really stop very much of what's going on if they don't particularly like it. And so, but if they go along with everything, then we really don't have a second voice. And the loyal opposition is not only in parliamentary forms of government like in Britain, but even in our form of government. It's always good to have somebody say it on the other hand. Hey, wait a minute. Hey, wait a minute. Hey, wait a minute. Listen to this. Mm-hmm. And so that is the role that the Republicans have to play. And when they're in such a minority, the issue is how they play it. Do they play it? Do they play it strictly on a political level, or do they raise serious issues about serious issues? And we'll find out.
Do you like the puppy?
Beg your pardon?
Do you like the puppy?
You know, that's one story I'm not on top of. I have only read about it. I like puppies, and I think the story about the puppies is terrific. But, yes, I will take a position on this. You've got me, Kathleen. I'll be a commentator. I will be a pundit. I'll give my opinion. Yes, I like the puppies.
Thank you, Jim, so much. Thanks
hey,
for
Kathleen,
the new book.
It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. Jim Lehrer, our guest, the first half hour for all things political. Executive editor, of course, and anchor of the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on PBS. And he has a new novel that has just been released. He is the author of so many novels, 19. Isn't that amazing? This one is Oh, Johnny, and it has just been published by Random House. We thank him for being with us. We're just switching guests and probably a little bit of focus now as we go to more international news. Our next guest has also released a book in paperback recently, Descent into Chaos. Ahmed Rashid is with us. He's the author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Taliban. He's a Pakistani journalist, and he also writes for the Wall Street Journal, The Nation, He appears regularly on international TV and radio networks, CNN and BBC. His 2000 book, Taliban, Militant Islam, Oil, and Fundamentalism in Central Asia, was a bestseller for a number of weeks. And his latest book is a scathing critique of both America and Europe's failure to invest in rebuilding Afghanistan and Pakistan's role in allowing Taliban and Al-Qaeda elements to regroup in Pakistan. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him, and our number remains the same. We're just trying to get him on the line here. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And you can also send an email if you'd like for all things political. That address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org for you to join our conversation. The second hour of our program today, it's captured our attention. It was a piece, in case you want to read it before we talk about it, by Edie Hirsch in the March. Where the heck are my notes for the second hour? Maybe on my desk, not here. March 28th, I'm thinking, issue of the New York Times, in which he writes about, as long as we're going to teach to the test, why not make the test be about the body of knowledge that we've accumulated instead of just filling the bubbles? So we'll be talking with Edie Hirsch. Cultural literacy, of course, is the movement that he started many years ago. He will be with us the second hour of our program. All right, we now go to Ahmed Rashid, and our number is 800-486-8655. Ahmed Rashid, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Let's start, if you don't mind, just for your comments on the rescue of Captain Phillips and the talk that the pirates in Somalia are saying that there will be retaliation here. What do you think will be the outcome of all of this, and what do you think about the capture and also the killing of the three young pirates?
Well, obviously it's been a huge success, and I'm sure it's a very big relief to the Obama administration faced with this crisis when they've got so many other things on their plate right now for this to be resolved so successfully. But essentially, the problem of Somalia being a failed state without a government, where Al-Qaeda and other extremist groups are also present, plus criminal pirate groups, the international community has to address this issue. I mean, because things are certainly only going to get worse. There will be revenge attacks. And it's the big danger is, of course, that you might get international terrorists based there. If that happens, then you'll be seeing Al-Qaeda in an area where there's absolutely no government and absolutely no control of them.
And is Al-Qaeda there in a big way right now?
Well, certainly they have some of the Islamic forces that have been in Somalia are allies of Al-Qaeda. But we have not seen Al-Qaeda central, as it were, organize terrorist attacks from Somalia outside of Somalia. You haven't seen, for example, Somalia being used as a base to attack Europe or to attack the United States. Now, you have seen one very disturbing trend, and that is young Somalis from the United States traveling to Somalia, becoming involved in these Islamic extremist groups and becoming suicide bombers for them. But they have not brought back that kind of expertise, if you like, to the United States so far. They're using it in Somalia. But it may not be long before you get young Somalis coming back to the United States and using themselves as suicide bombers.
So what does the response need to be, Ahmed?
Well, I think, the Obama approach is a multilateral approach. It's an approach you cannot do this on your own. You certainly can't bomb the Somalis into submission. You need a major international effort. And I think the Americans should go to the United Nations, to NATO, to the European Union, mobilize international support for some kind of major effort to get a peace process going in Somalia, which could be backed by aid and development if a new government would be formed.
It's hard to imagine what the outcome would have been if it had gone differently, if the captain had not survived this. Do you want to play that out or not?
Well, I mean, God forbid, if the captain had not survived this, there would probably have been a major military retaliation by the United States, on these pirate camps wherever they are. Although, of course, that could have led to the killing of the hostages, other hostages that they are holding. I'm glad it's been resolved in this way, but I mean, there's still a danger that one way the Somalis will take revenge is to kill some of the hostages from other ships that they are holding.
And why is it that nothing has really been done about the people who are being held by those on those other ships? They've been held for a long time, many of them.
Some of them have, and they are being, essentially, they're being ransomed, and these negotiations have got very prolonged and very complicated, and the delivery of the money from the ship owners who want to get their crews released and who are willing to pay up millions of dollars to get their crews released, I mean, that in itself is a very difficult problem. I mean, how do you get the cash money to these people, to the pirates, as it were?
And where is all of that money going?
It's a very good question, actually, because, a country like Somalia, I mean, you know, where do you spend $3 million in Somalia? It's not that there's a thriving economic boom there or something, or that you can have a good time or something. I think certainly a lot of the money is probably going outside in the sense that they are probably backers of these pirates who are living in Dubai or in the Arab states or even possibly amongst the Somali immigrants in Europe and other places. Some of this money could well be going to Al-Qaeda, who are in Pakistan and Afghanistan. So it's really a moot question. I mean, as to where such huge sums of money are actually going, because you can't spend it in Somalia.
Right. Let's talk about Pakistan for a moment. You write extensively about this. You're an expert in this part of the world. Do you think that it's hard to imagine one thing after another? They're all such huge issues. And let's talk about Pakistan for a moment. We had a guest last week who wrote the New York Times cover story on Pakistan saying that it in many ways just seems to be a chaotic country, that we've got a new president there, but doing pretty strange things, and the Taliban seems to be gaining in the frontier part of the country, and things seem to be descending into chaos.
Well, it's a very disturbing picture, and of course, much of the security of Afghanistan also rests in Pakistan. So the U.S. effort in Afghanistan is also very heavily dependent on what happens in Pakistan. Now, I think there are three major issues that we face in Pakistan. One, there's a very weak civilian government, which is at odds with the army, and the army continues to control foreign policy, policy towards India, policy towards Afghanistan, and even the United States. And there's also political confusion within the government, in the sense that the government is at odds with the opposition, and so there's a kind of political mayhem. There's a very severe economic crisis, which next week the donors will be meeting in Tokyo in order to give some kind of aid package to Pakistan, but Pakistan desperately needs an economic uplift. And thirdly, there is, of course, the threat to the spreading threat of the Pakistani Taliban, who are increasingly conquering territory in the north of the country and carrying out suicide attacks in major cities and other parts of the country. Now, I think a major U.S. initiative which involves itself in all three aspects. In other words, trying to help resolve the political crisis, giving aid to Pakistan and getting other donor countries to do the same, and at the same time persuading the Pakistan army to take a new track, to stop giving sanctuary to the Afghan Taliban, who are living in Pakistan, the leadership which is living in Pakistan, and also to help the military improve their capabilities in counterinsurgency. All this is needed.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think, let's talk about the president's increasing the number of people who will, troops who will be in Afghanistan and asking for support from NATO and winding up a little short on that front. Do you have an understanding of what those troops are going to be doing? Do you think that's the right course?
Yes, I do, because there's no question that, I mean, a lot of ground has been lost in Afghanistan. I think most of these American troops are going to go to the south of the country, to the southern provinces, which the Taliban are more or less controlling. Territory needs to be taken back. And then that territory needs to be held by an Afghan army, which is mentored with American troops, supported by American troops. And then you need to get the development agencies and work to take place to kind of, you know, do something for the people and to wean them away from, the fear of the Taliban that they have. So I think, a major thrust in the next 6 months has to be in the south of the country, and it has to be a coordinated thrust, not just a military surge, but a civilian and reconstruction surge, which is just as important.
Mm. What has happened, Mr. Rashid, with those development agencies? I know that there have been killings here. Is it safe for development agencies to be functioning there?
Well, in a large part of the country, it is safe. I mean, they're operating in the north and the west quite safely. It has not been safe in the south and the east, where the Taliban have taken so much territory. So I think what we are really seeing is we need to, secure. I mean, the Americans need to secure these areas in the south, where the population has been most intimidated and most harassed by the Taliban, and where, frankly, there's been very little development since 2001. These areas need to be taken back from the Taliban and made secure enough for the population and for the development agencies.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and we'll take them in just a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. All things political, and we are paying more attention to Somalia and Afghanistan and Pakistan this hour of the program with Ahmed Rashid. He is the author of Descent into Chaos, the U.S. and the Disaster in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia, and has had some interesting comments about Somalia and Islamic extremist groups in Somalia and where the money, the ransom money, may be going and what the response from the world community should be to piracy. We welcome your phone calls. Our lines are open for him. And you can also, it wasn't that long ago, news is moving pretty rapidly that the president asked for help for more troops from NATO countries for Afghanistan, and the country said pretty much no. What do you think needs to be done? Are you happy that he's asked for more troops? What about Pakistan, which seems to be getting more and more chaotic with each passing week? And as the president has said, this is probably one of the most dangerous countries in the world for us. Lines are open, 800-486-8655. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program this Monday, Edie Hirsch will join us, founder and chair of the nonprofit Core Knowledge Foundation. He wrote an interesting piece in the March 23rd New York Times, Reading Test Dummies. And we'll be talking about this issue. Before we throw away bubble tests, he says, we should institute a relatively simple change that would lessen the worst effects of the test prep culture and improve education in the bargain. So that's coming up. Should be a good hour. Let's go to phone calls next for Ahmed Rashid. His latest book is Descent into Chaos, the U.S. and the Disaster in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia. Mark from Middleton. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for coming on, Ahmed Rashid. I guess I'm really a big fan of your work. My question with regard is, what is the situation on the ground in Pakistan regarding sort of the major move of Talibanization into the country with the video coming out of SWAT? We hear about the Chief Justice talking, sort of taking a stand on it, and we hear about some human rights people in like Lahore and the more progressive cities, but sort of how are things swinging there?
Well, I think that, you know, there has been an enormous expansion of the Taliban ever since they took SWAT and the government really backed away from dealing with them in SWAT, and the ceasefire was made in SWAT. SWAT, by the way, is a valley just north of Islamabad, known as Pakistan's biggest tourist center. It's been taken by the Taliban, and the army has essentially pulled out of there. But the problem now is that the Taliban have strengthened themselves in SWAT, and they're spreading out to other adjacent valleys, spreading out across central northern Pakistan, intimidating local people, and then moving south closer and closer to the capital. And clearly, I mean, you know, we're all waiting to see what the army's going to do. And so far, at least, there has not been sufficient movement from the army to stop this process, and it's deeply worrying. This video that came out of the young girl being flogged by the Taliban in the Swat Valley, 17-year-old girl, has really, you know, gone around the world and has really affected many, many Pakistanis also. There's been very little coming out of Swat because the Taliban have literally closed it down in the sense that, you know, very restrictive towards them. The media, they have taken over the administration there, and many Pakistanis have been very, very deeply disturbed, and they are even more deeply disturbed at the fact that the government and the military do not seem to be taking any action there.
It's a sad thing. I spent a week in Swat in 1995, and, you know, I'll never forget the place, and it's sad to know that I may never go back.
It's very sad indeed, and you know, I hope we do resolve this problem and SWAT does go back to its own people.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you very much.
We go next to Frank from Madison. Hi, Frank.
Hi. May I ask your guest, and I hope this isn't obscure, but would he accept that this is a reprise of the late 19th century great game, and ultimately the United States, as well as the other powers, instead of the path to India, are concerned about the oil in the region and its control. But what the United States has consistently done is misestimate the situation and made moves that destabilize the region to its own detriment. So if you increase the number of troops there, you will get a negative response and the entire population will turn against an occupation, what looks like an occupation army. So can you ultimately go back to oil as a motivating influence rather than Islamicism, and that the United States should change its tactics? So thank you.
Thank you, Frank. As always.
Well, I think this oil issue is kind of overstated simply because the oil is actually very far away from Afghanistan, Pakistan. Pakistan and Afghanistan are very they're deficit countries in terms of energy. The oil is in Kazakhstan, which is far to the west of Central Asia, and it's in Iran, which is really not accessible to the Americans at the moment. So I don't think oil is a major factor. I think really the threat of Al-Qaeda remains very serious for the Americans and for the Europeans. Yes, I mean, you know, eventually, I'm sure the Americans would like to see stability in Afghanistan, and so would the Pakistanis and the Indians, so that oil could then travel through pipelines across from Central Asia, across Afghanistan, and into South Asia, into India and Pakistan. That would be extremely beneficial to Afghanistan, to Pakistan, to all the countries through which these pipelines would cross, because obviously infrastructure would be built up, the economy would boom, etc. But we're not going to see that until there's stability and until there's an end to the Taliban, because nobody's going to build anything as long as the Taliban are around. And secondly, I think with the great game, I think the really big difference here is that we're dealing with the phenomenon of Islamic extremism. The great game of the 19th century was fought between the British in India and the Russians, the Russians in what was then Russia and Central Asia, and then the smaller countries like Afghanistan and Iran. But it didn't really involve that degree of this kind of organized Islamic extremism that we're seeing today. I mean, certainly there were wars by the tribesmen against the British, and there were sort of mini jihads that were launched, but nothing of the scale today where we are seeing the Taliban move from becoming Afghan Taliban, they are now Pakistani Taliban, they're Central Asian Taliban. Tomorrow you may get the formation of Indian Taliban. So the Taliban is becoming a kind of role model for the whole region, and this is something very new.
And did you expect this would happen after September 11th? Many of us, I think, expected that it would go away.
Well, I certainly, you know, was writing as early as 2002 that, you know, there was evidence that the Afghan Taliban leadership had been given sanctuary in Pakistan, and I was writing very seriously that if the Pakistani military and the intelligence agencies allows this to happen, we are these Afghan Taliban are going to be the death of us, because they are going to create a Pakistani Taliban. Because in order to live in Pakistan, they will have to create more allies and sympathy. And that's exactly what's happened. And we now have a Taliban movement on Pakistani soil, which is probably more lethal than even the Afghan Taliban.
And what's attractive about it? Why would people join?
Well, there are many reasons. I mean, first of all, you know, don't forget that these Afghan Taliban and Al-Qaeda have been living up on the Pakistan border with these tribesmen, with these Pashtun tribesmen, for the last 7 years. Now, there's obviously a process of radicalization that takes place. I mean, although, you know, you are the host, but you get in, if the guest is staying for 7 years, you will get influenced by the guest and what he's saying. The guest is also paying very, very big money to you for staying. So Al-Qaeda and the Afghan Taliban were dishing out large sums of money. That's been part of it. And the other thing is that, you know, there's been the Pakistan state has really not carried out any kind of development work in that area. It should have moved into that area after 2001, after the war ended, secured that area, and then carried out development work and prevented these foreigners, the Afghan Taliban and Al-Qaeda, from being able to carry on living there. But the army did not move into that area until at the end of 2004. So really, for about 3.5-4 years, these groups were able to live there without any harassment whatsoever and woo their hosts, which are today, of course, become the Pakistani Taliban.
Right. Thanks, Frank, for your call. Let's go to Shelley from Madison next. Hi, Shelley.
Hi. Thank you for a wonderful program today. I appreciate it. I have a question that builds on the last. First of all, I am wondering, warring has been going on in that very rugged region, the top of the world, for thousands of years, long before oil was the issue or whatever. I'm curious about what the gain and the goal of that part of the world is as far as territory. That's one. And second, with the last comments that the speaker just made, how does a country like the United States or any of the European countries, how do they counter what's going on with the Taliban?
Well, you know, I think you know, if you read my book, I think a lot of the mistakes there were real policy mistakes that were made by the Bush administration, and I think what Obama is trying to do is to rectify them. A lot of the things that were promised of rebuilding, reconstruction, job creation, all these kinds of things that were promised by the Bush administration back in 2002, 2003 were never fulfilled, and I think a lot of the civilian side of the new Obama plan is trying to fulfill what was promised 5, 6, 7 years ago. So I think, you know, certainly if the right policies had been conducted earlier on, and don't forget there was no insurgency between 2001 and 2004. The Taliban were licking their wounds. They were not fighting. That was the time, that was the window of opportunity when reconstruction could have taken place, when the aid agencies could have gone in and worked. But you know, the Americans didn't give the resources because, you know, there was focusing on Iraq, there was a lack of interest in Afghanistan. So unfortunately, what we've seen is a long list and line of policy mistakes made not just by the United States, but by the European countries, by NATO, not doing the right thing at the right time, essentially. And now I think, you know, the Obama team want to do the right thing, but it's going to cost you much more. It's going to need far more troops. It's going to be far more difficult. But still, I think it's still doable because essentially the Afghan people, no matter how frustrated or angry they may be at being let down by the Americans and the international community, I still think they, you know, the majority of them do not want the Taliban back.
Mm-hmm. You talked about money earlier and the Taliban being able to pay their host country money. Where is that money coming from, Ahmed?
Well, a lot of that money is coming from drugs. Afghanistan is the largest producer of heroin in the world. Some 93% of the world's heroin, a quite staggering figure if you think about it.
Yes.
I mean, comes from Afghanistan. And both the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are deeply involved in protecting the farmers who are growing poppy, from which heroin comes from, and taking cuts all down the line. They take a cut from the farmers, they take a cut from the transporters who ship the stuff out of Afghanistan, they take a cut from the laboratories who turn the poppy opium resin into heroin, and now they're involved even in trafficking outside in the Middle East, in Russia, to get the stuff to Europe. And once you start trafficking, of course, then your profits zoom upwards because,
right.
You know, the opium is costing far more outside than it is inside Afghanistan.
Uh-huh. Ahmed Rashid, thank you so much for being with us. What a world, huh? His latest book, Descent into Chaos, the U.S. and the Disaster in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia. Thanks to Carmen Jackson, Rhonda Fanning, and Rob Schroeder for producing this hour. Thanks for your calls, everybody. News coming up, and we'll return.